serious question. What good does it do to send somebody to prison after they're convicted of a crime? Many people might say bad behavior deserves punishment. But if the ultimate goal is a society where fewer crimes happen, does the American carceral system actually achieve that? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The vast size and punitive culture of the system we have today is not only different from what exists in some other countries, it's different from what the creators of one of our earliest penitentiaries dreamed of when they set contrition and restoration as goals that were just as important as retribution. There are numerous reasons for the ways U.S. prisons have changed over the decades, and these days there's growing momentum for yet another evolution toward a system that offers a path to very different lives for people who serve their sentences and re-enter our communities. Bill Keller is founding editor-in-chief of the Marshall Project and author of the book What's Prison For? Punishment and Rehabilitation in the Age of Mass Incarceration. Bill, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
I really love this deceptively simple question of what incarceration is for, because until we decide the answer collectively, it seems like we're not actually likely to benefit as a society from the existence of prisons, right?
That's right. And we've been arguing what the purpose of prison is for 200 years.
What are some of the possible answers to that question?
Most experts come up with four. Not that they're necessarily we're necessarily fulfilling any of the four, but the first one is punishment, of course, which is this is the way society says you broke a rule and you deserve to be held accountable for it. There's incapacitation, which says if as long as you're locked up, there's a limit to what harm you can do to the general public. There's deterrence, the idea that it would give a potential criminal pause, knowing that there's a pretty severe penalty at the end of the road if it gets caught. And then there's rehabilitation, which is trying to assure that the people who were incarcerated, who will eventually get out, 95% of them do, will be capable of re-entering the world as a citizen and your next-door neighbor.
So early in the book, Bill, you take us back to this day in 1829 when a brand new penitentiary outside Philadelphia locked up its first inmate. This, of course, was not the first prison in American history, but Eastern State Penitentiary did represent a kind of radical new approach inspired, what, by Quaker philosophy, right?
That's right. It was a gang of do-gooders in Philadelphia, one of whom was Ben Franklin, by the way, who decided that the purpose of prison should be, well, they called it a penitentiary, which implies you're penitent. The idea of being locked up by yourself was that you would contemplate, think lofty thoughts, do some mild modest labor, and you would be isolated. The fundamental flaw in the design was the isolation part, because we now know that long periods of isolation can make you literally crazy and drive you to suicide or to other self-harm. And we're still debating to this day the extent to which isolation should be used as a punishment or a control mechanism in our prisons.
So if early American prisons in the North did consider rehabilitation a core part of their mission, what made prisons in Southern states so different, especially after the Civil War?
Well, the short answer is slavery. And the slightly more elaborate answer is the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which abolished slavery with one exception. That is, you could enslave somebody who was convicted of a serious crime. The South took advantage of that loophole so that instead of having enslaved men and women working the fields for the plantation, you had incarcerated men, mostly men, laboring for whoever the owner of the property was. The states would sometimes rent out convict labor to farmers or other businessmen.
And so how did the purely punitive function of Southern prisons come to influence conditions of incarceration everywhere in the country?
Well, first of all, the 13th Amendment loophole applied. There were some creative minds in the North that took advantage of it as well. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't strictly a Southern thing. Sorry, I lost my train of thought.
It's okay. I mean, Southern prisons, you know, at first, Northern prisons wanted to rehabilitate as part of their mission. Southern prisons came along and wanted to use formerly enslaved people as free prison labor. So basically, this idea arose in U.S. culture, right, that it was fine to just make prisons a place where people should suffer for their crimes.
That's well put. I couldn't put it any better myself.
How did the war on drugs lead to, I guess at the height of it, 2.3 million Americans behind bars at one time?
Yeah, the war on drugs was a major factor. And there was a sort of panic in the 60s and especially in the 70s, 1970s, a combination of things going on. There was actually a rise in crime, but the war on drugs was responsible for a large portion of the incarceration and particularly for incarceration of Black people, because the drug laws were enforced more strictly. First of all, some of the drug laws, like the war on crack, were designed in a way that automatically impacted Black and low-income communities, because crack is a drug that's sold in small doses to people who don't have a lot of money to spare, whereas powder cocaine is generally a drug for better off users. So that was part of it. And then even the drugs the drug laws that were ostensibly race neutral were enforced differently. I mean, I smoked pot when I was young. I did it in a college dormitory where I wasn't likely to get busted, but a lot of people don't have that luxury, and they were smoking pots on the street or in places that came under heavy police surveillance. And so the number of Black men arrested for pot, simple possession and trafficking in pot, was way out of proportion to the Black population.
By the 1970s, victims' rights movements had begun to emerge. And I think, Bill, you know, few people would argue that victims' voices matter in crime and punishment, but it's not surprising that victims very rarely called for mercy on those who had harmed them.
That's correct. Yeah, I think anybody who's thought about it believes that the victim should be heard, but the victims are likely to be motivated by a sense of a need for vengeance, and vengeance isn't a very sound basis for a legal system.
How did the rise of the private prison industry create financial incentives for longer prison sentences?
The private prison industry, which really got its start in the Reagan era, was a convenient way for the states to offload and the federal government to offload a heavy responsibility to the private sector. Privately run prisons only incarcerate about 10% of our prison population, but that doesn't tell the whole story. Even state prisons contract out a lot of their work, the medical care, the uniforms, the cafeteria. And so there's a considerable profit motive in keeping people in prison.
On the surface of things, when we talk about the flaws in the American carceral system, it's often presented, right, as this kind of classic right-left dichotomy in which conservatives want maximum punishment for people who commit crimes, progressives call for clemency. How did it happen that a prison reform movement has really gained traction in conservative circles?
Yeah, the black-white notion is wrong in both directions. First of all, much of the strong support, or tougher, some would say exceedingly harsh penalties, came from Democrats, liberal Democrats, and in some cases with strong support from black communities, which were not only. One of the paradoxes is that black communities are both under-policed and over-policed. They're policed too aggressively, but the police aren't there to do the things that you want them to do, like solve the crimes.
And so conservatives now have taken the lead in some, moves to reduce overall prison populations, which has happened by about 500,000 people in recent years. But it's not just about saving money, right, that would otherwise be spent keeping people locked up.
Well, for the conservatives who support criminal justice reform, saving money, it tends to be a larger factor than it is for liberals or progressives who favor reforms. But there are other factors as well. Back in December 2015, I wrote a piece in The New Yorker about this relatively new phenomenon of a conservative lobby for criminal justice reform. And it was partly libertarian streak that the corrections department is just another example of oppressive big government like the IRS. If some of it came from evangelical circles, particularly followers of a few high profile prisoners from Watergate who evangelized, who had underwent a conversion in prison and then evangelized for more humane treatment. And some of it was just sort of conservative disgust at the waste that they saw, the waste of human potential and the waste of money. And it's just not to say that liberals and conservatives agree down the board on what is a worthwhile prison reform, but there was a broad general agreement that we incarcerate too many people for too long compared to the rest of the world and compared to just the necessities of maintaining a safe society. And there was agreement on some of the particulars for how to resolve that. For example, mandatory minimum sentences, which were a big thing in the 80s and 90s, mandatory minimum sentences, three strikes laws, and those sorts of harsh sentencing protocols had the opposition of both progressives and conservatives.
Bill, to go back to the four main purposes of prison, right? Punishment, incapacitation, deterrence, and rehabilitation. What do social scientists know about why crime rates rise and fall over time, and how closely that's related to the way we do prison?
Well, I can sort of take the four justifications for prison in order. Punishment is, I think there's a general agreement that we want to punish people for doing bad things, but it's kind of an amorphous kind of what is enough? How do you make the punishment fit the crime? That's a puzzle, and we tend to over-punish in this country compared not only to what other countries do, but what we did ourselves for most of the last century. Incapacitation and deterrence are both sounds like obvious reasons to lock people up, but what they don't take into account is that the experience of prison often makes people more likely to commit crime rather than less likely to commit crime. So it's a trade-off that hardly seems worth it. And then rehabilitation only works if you invest in doing it. In a typical year, 600,000 Americans are released from state or federal prisons. Way too many of them have had no job training, no therapy to help their anger issues, they're alienated, they're stigmatized, and we let them out into the real world, and not surprisingly, two-thirds of them come back. So, I mean, it's pretty clear from my book that I'm a believer in rehabilitation, but I don't have any confidence that it's going to eliminate the need for prisons.
Bill, we know that a far greater percentage of Americans are incarcerated compared with pretty much any other wealthy democracy on the planet. And also, you know, compared with many countries we consider less than democratic. But we also impose very different conditions. Tell us what you learned about life inside a maximum security prison in Germany.
Sure. We sent a reporter along with in the last 15 years or so, there have been a number of field trips organized by groups like the Vera Institute to take American corrections officials and politicians over to see how they do it in Germany and Norway and the Netherlands and other places. And these exchanges have been kind of two ways. The first shock they get when they arrive in the specific field trip that you're talking about to a maximum security prison in Germany, the first shock is how it resembles sort of a college campus. There's a garden. There are kitchens that inmates can use. And the philosophy is that punishment is you're being deprived of your freedom for a period of time, but you retain all of your other rights while you're incarcerated, including the right to safety, the right to earn a living, the right to education, the right to vote, the right to conjugal visits with your spouse. And that philosophy applied on the ground makes for prisons that look much different than prisons in America. But the even bigger shock for Americans who visit Germany and Norway is the role that the staff play. In order to become a correctional officer in Germany, you do 2 years of college level training, including not just training in how to control prisoners, but training in human rights law and psychology. And your job is not seen as it is in this country, as just containing the prisoners, but it's to engage with them, to try to diagnose what it was that led them to commit crime and try to fix that. There's a sort of air of social work about the role of corrections officers in Norway or Germany, whereas in the US they're likely to get a few weeks of training and it's mostly in crowd control and self-defense.
So people might be thinking that sounds fine, but what are the results? How do recidivism rates in places like Germany and Norway and the Netherlands compare with those we find in the US?
Well, they're much lower. The recidivism rates are much lower in Germany and the Scandinavian countries. And there are other factors beyond the way prisons operate for that. I mean, those are countries that are less likely to have racial animosities. They're Norway, for example. You know, the United States is not Norway, which is a largely homogeneous, oil-rich welfare state. But the basic philosophy that your job is to make this person fit into society in a way that makes them a good citizen and a good neighbor, that doesn't seem to me to be too remote from the possibility for this country.
It blew my mind to discover reading this book that ideas of this kind are being sort of pilot tested in some U.S. prisons, including in deep red states like North Dakota.
Yes, that's right. That's largely the result of some leaders who went on these field trips and studied them in North Dakota. They had exchanges with the corrections officers, went and trailed corrections officers in Norway. And they had a fairly charismatic leader of the corrections department who decided to focus, first of all, on the staff. A number of states are trying different kinds of things. Connecticut is doing a focus on young offenders. Oregon tries to treat prisons sort of like part of the healthcare system. Philadelphia has one prison unit that's called Little Scandinavia that is trying to do a pilot project to demonstrate that the Norwegian model can work. North Dakota's, well, all of them are short on data because they're mostly young and young programs and on a small scale. But I've talked to corrections officials at the upper levels in all four of those states that I named, and they're convinced that it makes for a safer environment in the prison and a significantly lower recidivism rate when they get out.
And a lot of these reformed programs tend to focus more on carrots than on sticks, which is really different from the way we imagine, you know, life in most U.S. prisons. How are inmates rewarded for good behavior?
You know, it's just you should ask that. I want to refer to a book, not my own book, which is my purpose for being here, but a book called Reshaping the Texas Prison System for Better Public Safety. It's written by a lifer and published earlier this year. And so the writer's name is Aaron Flaherty. He's still somewhere in the prison system. And one of his main arguments is that incentives work better than punishment. I don't know how you establish that as a scientific fact, but it has a certain logic to it. And we've seen incremental uses of rewards where inmates get more privileges, more family visits. They are allowed to wear non-conforming uniforms. They have access to a kitchen, for example, of more fresh fruit and vegetables, which are a scarcity in prisons. And they get responsibilities. One of the most moving things that I saw in my reporting is in that prison, the Little Scandinavia prison in Pennsylvania, where they've taken a group of prisoners serving life sentences and made them mentors to the younger prisoners in the unit. And when it works, which it tends to work because the lifers have been there a long time and have and know the lay of the land, everybody benefits. The younger prisoners benefit from the wisdom of the older prisoners, and the older prisoners, the lifers, get a sense of purpose out of it.
Is it much more expensive to do prison in this sort of more open way that emphasizes rewards instead of punishments?
Yes, and I'm sorry to say that the idea of defunding prisons isn't going to work. First of all, you usually have to make some infrastructure changes, because prisons are essentially stacks of cages. And if you want to do a less regimented routine, you probably want some dormitories, some common spaces, and so on. The big difference in cost is staffing ratios. In American prisons, a single corrections officer might have 10 inmates under his charge. It doesn't give him an opportunity to get to know them, to anticipate whether they're going to have a mental breakdown or a fight is about to break out. the corrections officers are often overwhelmed by their responsibilities.
This is something that you also cover in the book. What can our systems do to make work more tolerable for those corrections officers and also give them more tools to do their job in ways that are not sort of instantly relying on punishment to manage challenging situations?
Well, we referred earlier to North Dakota's system where they had considerable success in doing the kinds of things that Don was talking about. But one of the reasons they were able to do that is that their corrections officers aren't unionized. And sometimes, I have nothing against unions, but sometimes, maybe more than just sometimes, the corrections officers become the source of resistance. The chapter in my book on the staff is called The Other Prisoners. And I think it's important to recognize that they don't take the jobs out of some sadistic pleasure in torturing their fellow humans. It's understaffing, fear, and it's philosophy that, although nobody ever quite puts it that way, but philosophy is our job is to make sure they don't get out. That's job one and job two and job three.
Don mentioned training to become a dental technician when he was incarcerated. I know that higher education for inmates is really controversial. What are the best arguments for educating inmates while they're serving time, up to and including allowing them to earn college degrees at taxpayer expense?
The best argument for that is to not think of it as a favor or a gift that you're giving to people who committed crimes, but an investment. The recidivism rate goes down. There's research in the area of criminal justice is often should be taken with a grain of salt, but there's one of the areas where there is really good research, some of the best done by the Rand Corporation, shows that college level education has a dramatic effect on lowering recidivism. And that's back in the 1994 crime bill, which Joe Biden was the judiciary chairman on and has sort of apologized for since becoming president. One of the features of that bill was to abolish federal Pell Grants for college students who are incarcerated. They've now recently undone that limit and should lead to more. It's definitely a sign of progress. Should lead to more college degree programs being available in prisons.
You mentioned in the book that you had the opportunity to teach some college level classes to inmates. What was your experience like?
Yeah, my experience was eye-opening and short-lived because I had 4 weeks of classes and then the pandemic hit. I was teaching at Sing Sing, a seminar on basically about the news business. Had 16 inmates, all of them in their 50s, all black and brown. And all of them were what they call at Sing Sing alumni, meaning they had every one of them had gotten at least one degree, college degree while incarcerated. Mine was a sort of graduate level course. And a couple of things struck me. The first assignment I gave them was a kind of standard assignment for a writing seminar. You know, tell me in 300 words a scene from your life. It can be anything from your childhood, from your adult life, or if you're your incarcerated life. Give me 300 or 400 words and really convey the scene to me. I'd done that the previous semester with a seminar at Princeton of undergraduates. But the answers that I got, the essays that I got from the Sing Sing students were not the least bit like the ones that I got from my Princeton students. And it was a reminder that a crime isn't just an act, it comes with a context and a history. So two or three of my essays talked about children discovering dead bodies. A couple of them described the humiliation of strip search. One of them described one described a happy situation, which was finding a favorite video game in one of the rooms that they used for family visits.
So these were motivated students. They had very different stories to tell, and these are stories, I guess, that historically our prison system has not shown much interest in.
Yeah, we aren't that big about diagnosing the problems that. I mean, one of the things that struck me about that class was, and it strikes me over and over again in talking and writing about this subject, is that there's such a tremendous waste of human capital. A couple of my students, by the way, got out, were paroled, and I've been in touch with them. They're both employed, supporting their families. I mean, I'm not peering into their lives, but they sound like they've definitely benefited from the educational opportunities they had behind bars. This is not to say that people in prisons are angels or that they haven't done bad things, but time and again, I've met people who are still in prison and people who have gotten out of prison who showed immense talent. I'll give you an example of one that we hired at the Marshall Project. We've hired a couple of formerly incarcerated people, one named Lawrence Bartley, who did 20 some years in New York State prisons. And when he got out and came to work at the Marshall Project, he took the initiative to, the Marshall Project does reporting for mainstream media for our website and in partnership with other newspapers and news organizations. But he single-handedly invented a new print product from the Marshall Project on printed on paper and aimed at prisoners. So it's called News Inside. And he went and lobbied wardens or superintendents, as they prefer to be called, for access. And he's now in more than 700 prisons are receiving this newsletters, which are sort of greatest hits about criminal justice from the Marshall Project. I mean, that is such an entrepreneurial accomplishment that I every time I talk to him, I wonder, what if those 20 years had been spent doing something other than living in a cell?
Bill Keller is founding editor-in-chief of the Marshall Project and author of the book What's Prison For? Punishment and Rehabilitation in the Age of Mass Incarceration. Bill, thanks very much for spending this time with us.
Thanks for having me.
You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram just by searching for KERA Think. That's also what you search wherever you get your podcast to subscribe to ours. Or you can listen on our website where you can sign up as well for our new Think e-newsletter. That is think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.